we are going to be finishing off this series. We're tying a bow on this series, More, Your God is Too Small. It's a series that we have used a book by J.B. Phillips, a book that was written 60 years ago, and has that title, Your God is Too Small, and we've used it as a springboard to look at different ways to view God that are indeed too small, that beg for us to have a more and bigger view of who God is. I hope you've enjoyed unpacking some of these ideas and looking to the biblical anchors that hold us to those ideas of God being much bigger, much more, much stronger, much wider than we could ever truly imagine. But today is the end, and I think it's actually a great conclusion talking about the too small view of God, who is a managing director, as J.B. Phillips calls it in the book. A view of God simply as a managing director. We're going to unpack that idea in just a few moments, but I thought first we would start with this. I want to remind you of exactly how pitifully insignificant you are. And I know what you're thinking. Pete, I don't think you understand how the sermon works. It's not what I'm here for. I'm here to be encouraged and empowered and set on fire. And listen, I promise you we will get to the encouraging stuff, but I want us to get together in sort of a frame of mind to understand why this view of God as a managing director is so easy to get to and potentially so common in our world. So, are you ready to be made to feel insignificant? Great. Let's do it together. How about this for insignificance? You are 1 in 7.9 billion people on planet Earth. Approximately. You are 1 in 7.9 billion people. This week, as I was working on the sermon, I found a website that is simply a world population clock, as it were. And I got to tell you, you just sit and watch that for just a few seconds, and you're kind of overwhelmed as you watch, based on birth and death rates, these numbers just growing and changing and climbing. You are 1 out of 7.9 billion people on planet Earth. If you think, wow, great job, I feel pretty insignificant. Oh, wait, it's going to get so much worse. There is so much more where that came from. Are you ready? Let's continue on. The planet on which you reside is one of 8 planets in our solar system. You've heard about Pluto, right? Okay, good. Funny enough, though, the scientist who actually advocated successfully for Pluto to be demoted to a dwarf planet is, to this day, certain they believe there's actually another 9th planet out there somewhere. They can see the effects of it in the solar system, so he's hunting to make up for what he has torn apart. So, right now, 8 planets, and ours isn't even the biggest one. Jupiter is significantly bigger than Earth, more than 10 times bigger, which means if our Earth and all of its vastness is the size of a nickel, Jupiter is the size approximately of a basketball. So much bigger that planet is. And there are 8 of them. Feeling insignificant yet? Let's keep going. Our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, is one of 10 billion galaxies in the observable universe. Billion with a B. 10 billion galaxies, and our Milky Way galaxy is simply one of those. And if you're thinking, all right, I don't feel quite insignificant enough yet, I've got one more for you. So here we go. Our sun is a star. Many of you know that. And it exists in our solar system in the Milky Way. What you may not know, it's one of the 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, and it's one of the billion trillion stars in our observable universe. And I read that phrasing, a billion trillion, and I just thought, doesn't that sound like a made-up number that kids would use when they're arguing? Like, nuh-uh, my dad's a billion trillion times stronger than your dad. It sounds like a made-up number. I promise you it's not. The scientific version of it is like a 10 with a whole bunch of exponents and zeros and everything like that. But our sun is 1 in a billion trillion stars, approximately, in the observable universe. With all of that being said, J.B. Phillips in the book puts it this way. It might seem that the God who is responsible for the vastness of the universe cannot possibly be interested in the lives of the minute specks of consciousness which exist on this insignificant planet. Since God is so huge and our whole sphere of life so small by comparison, we cannot conceive his taking any detailed interest in a single human life. This is God as the managing director. And I will say this, and we're going to unpack it in a bit. It actually looks like a big God view on the surface. But it's actually, as you'll find, it's a false positive. You're familiar with a false positive, like in the medical industry. It's a false positive because it's a view of God that says, he is so big and so vast and so beyond, surely he can't care anything about me. I'm such a speck of minute consciousness on this insignificant planet. It seems like, well, we're making a big God really, really big, but it's actually a false positive, which we're going to unpack in just a little bit. But it's not just statistics about the bigness of the population or the earth or the universe. And it's not just quotes from J.B. Phillips. We find this sentiment expressed in Scripture itself. Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. And I love that reading in the NIV, but I looked up in the Message, sort of a poetic paraphrase of Scripture by Eugene Peterson. I really, really love this version as well. I look up at your macro skies, dark and enormous, your handmade sky jewelry, moon and stars mounted in their settings. And then I look at my micro self and wonder, why do you bother with us? Why take a second look our way? And beyond the statistics and the quotes in the Scripture, there's one more place that I thought of where we find this. It's in some song lyrics. A band named Casting Crowns had a song several years ago called Who Am I? And the lyrics include these lines. Who am I that the Lord of all the earth would care to know my name, would care to feel my hurt? Who am I that the bright and morning star would choose to light the way for my ever-wandering heart? This is viewing God as this managing director who's so far above and beyond. He's really, really, really big, but that also means that his connection with you as a small, insignificant speck of consciousness on the earth is quite laughable. So how do we get to this place? Well, I would argue one of the ways we get there is by applying some things to God that actually shouldn't be applied to God. And let me unpack it for you this way. There's a social scientist named Dunbar who did some research several years back trying to figure out how many truly meaningful relationships can the average human being sustain. So let me ask you, think about this. How many friends do you have? Oh, wait. Yeah, I mean, it's a big number, right? And for some of you, you go to Facebook or social media, you're like, I have 1,000 friends. No, you probably don't. You probably don't. No, at least not by this definition of what it means to have a friend. How many people do you know? How many friends do you have? So according to the research that's been done, and it's been debated back and forth, but it's something that is at least a point of discussion. According to the research, Dunbar's number, that's the name of the person who did the initial research, Dunbar's number is a suggested cognitive limit to the number of people with whom one person can maintain stable social relationships. And I've waited long enough, you've formulated a guess in your mind, how many relationships can you successfully sustain as a human being? On average, the answer is about 150. You can sustain meaningful social relationships with about 150 people. And what this means is people that you can know very well and know if that person connects to other people that you know. So about 150. And this is debated. It's not a hard and fast number. But generally speaking, it's the idea that we as human beings, we're limited, right? We are limited. But Dunbar's research included not only brain science, but also some fascinating things anecdotally from history. For instance, the average Stone Age farming village, about 150 people. The average size, there was an Anabaptist movement called the Hutterites in Europe in the 1500s, and they would get to up to about 150 people, and then they would split off, and they would form a new community. 150 is pretty close to the basic unit size for a professional army, back all the way into Roman antiquity and even up into modern times, about 150 people. And the most fascinating one to me, by trial and error, the leadership board in the company that makes Gore-Tex discovered that if there are more than 150 employees in any facility working together in one building, that some unique social problems occur. And I really like the way they worded that. Some unique social problems crop up when you push much past 150. So do you know what they did? They would build a building that would sustain 150 people, no more, and a parking lot for 150 vehicles and no more, and once that was maxed out, they would build another building, sometimes right next door, for 150 people with 150 parking spots, because they found that you push much past that and some unique social problems start to develop. So here's what this all means. I think we tend to sometimes see God as a managing director when we apply this very measurable human limitation to God himself. That's how we get to see God as a managing director. Because we say to ourselves, I can barely sustain a relationship with 150 or so people. I don't know how in the world God could do it with 1,500 or 15,000 or 15 million. And we don't always do it knowingly, but we apply these human limitations to God. How could he ever know that many people? J.B. Phillips in the book talks about it this way. He says, imagine if you were a manager of 50 people. He says, you could pretty easily, I quote, he says, make yourself familiar with the history, character, abilities, and peculiarities of each one of those 50 people. And I would agree, managing 50 people, it's doable. But he says, increase that to 500. Things get a little dicey. You can still have a personal interest in each of those people, but retaining personal details about each one of the 500, that would be pretty challenging. And then he says, imagine if it was 5,000. If you're managing 5,000 people, retaining even a small percentage of details about a few of them would be really hard. In other words, the higher up you get in a room full of people, the fewer true personal connections you can have with the people in that room. And applying that idea to God, Philip says, the highest person of all, God, must have the fewest contact with actual individual people, because especially if he's infinitely high above us, the idea of being in contact with us becomes laughable because there are so many. And I was thinking about this view of God, and it reminded me of a particular character from a particular movie. Do you guys remember Mr. Shirley from Christmas Vacation, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation? I saw this character in my brain. Because if you've seen the movie, you know that, like, you know, he has these people who march behind him, who he doesn't really actually know, probably. There's the scene where Clark brings the Christmas gift, and there's this gigantic table that separates the two of them, this huge distance between them. And probably the most telling thing in the movie, Mr. Shirley never calls Clark by his actual name. He always calls him something else. Why? Because he doesn't know him. And we can sometimes view God like this, that he's big and he's important. And we need to march behind him and serve him, but the idea of him actually knowing me, knowing us as individuals, that's a little bit too much. Think about specifically how we feel about the idea of God simultaneously hearing and answering all the prayers and aspirations of people all over the world. Philip says, this is kind of a worrisome thing to try and consider from this perspective. And he says, we sometimes imagine a harassed telephone operator answering callers at a switchboard of superhuman size. And I do like that metaphor, but I think there's actually a better one that has come up in our world for us today. Do you guys remember the movie Bruce Almighty, starring Jim Carrey, where he sort of got all these the powers of God? And it's intended to be a comedy, but there's actually some really interesting theological discussion that can happen as a part of this movie. Anyway, he is given like the power to be God. And one of the things he has to handle are all these prayers. And you see him eventually in the movie like rubbing his ear saying, I can't get these voices to stop because they're just constant prayers happening, constantly coming at me. And so he says, I've got to get a system to figure this out because I can't keep doing this. And his first idea, he says, oh no, let all prayers be files. And then the scene populates with these file drawers like all over the room. And he says in the movie, well, not a space saver, but at least the voices are gone. So he thinks some more. What can I do? What's a better system? The next idea, if you remembered, he says, let all prayers be post-its. And all these post-it notes sweep into the room and cover everything, including him and the dog and whatnot. And he realizes this is not going to be a sustainable solution either. So his final thing that he lands on, he says, let all prayers be emails. And he sits down at his computer and watches all these prayer emails pour in. We do that sometimes with God, that he must be so overwhelmed at all of this. How could he maintain or sustain? And Phillips essentially says this, to hold a concept of God as a mere magnified human being, this managing director, is to run the risk of thinking of him as simply the commander-in-chief who cannot possibly spare the time to attend to the details of his subordinates' lives. And viewing God in this way is really easy. It's really tempting. You feel like you're giving this big, big view of God, and in some ways it is, but it's actually in other ways quite limiting, because think about this alternative for the second. What if God is way more than a magnified human being? What if by taking our own limitations and somehow applying them to him, we're doing him a disservice? Because I want to remind you today, maybe you don't know this, but your mental conception of God is nowhere near the actual fullness of God. Whatever we're able to understand, and sometimes it's a lot, but it still pales in comparison to the real thing. What you understand and the reality of God are probably very, very different things, because he's big and he's more. So we can't imagine having multitudes of true and intimate connections with millions or billions of people, let alone all at the same time. But why do we say God can't? Why do we think that God isn't capable? And I want to give you three examples this morning from Scripture to show you that he is more than capable. And I could give you 6, 10, 12. But listen, there's NFL football on this afternoon. We need to get... I'm just kidding. I'm totally joking. I would use all of them if I felt I needed to. But I think just these three is a great introduction to the idea that God is so much more than just a managing director of the universe. Here's the first one, Psalm 139, the first four verses. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. I'm going to read that again if you want to watch it on the screen. But this time I'm going to emphasize the first person language just to drive it home, right? You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit, when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, Lord, you know it completely. And I want to drive home that distinction because so much of Scripture is intended to be read and understood collectively. It's written to groups of people. This is one of the few times in Scripture where it's made like abundantly clear. You as an individual are being talked about here through these divinely inspired words that we receive through the psalm. You. I mean us, yes, but you. Think of the externals first. My sitting, my rising, my going out, my lying down. God is lovingly attentive to all the movements of your outward and physical life. The language that's there in the psalm that we translate as my going out and my lying down, I read a commentary this week that says, it literally says in the Hebrew, my path and my couch. I really like that. My path and my couch. God is lovingly attentive all the times, I'm on my path, I'm on my path. But when my path ends and I crash on my couch, still present, still there. All of the outward movements of my physical life are under the lovingly attentive view of God. But it doesn't stop there. By the way, the only thing in our lives that we can maybe compare this to, the idea of all of our outward movements, is our cell phones. Now, if you haven't looked into how much your cell phone actually tracks you, actually don't. You won't, it's not pretty. You're going to want to like take the card out and stomp it on the ground and walk away and burn it to ashes, because it is wild, wild how much your provider and your apps know. They are tracing your every move, which sometimes is good. When I get suggestions that say, we think you might like, a lot of times it's right. But that's like the only other thing. God is watching everything, not just inward parts, outward parts, but inward as well. My thoughts, my words, even before I speak them, God is lovingly attentive to all the motivations of your inward spiritual life as well. And I chose the word motivation specifically because it talks about how God perceives our thoughts. It's not that Jesus knows them, because if it's like God knows my thoughts, we can view that as like a data dump, that there's just this big file system and there's a spreadsheet and God sort of tracks all your thoughts and puts them in storage somewhere in the cloud. In the clouds? In the cloud? No? Okay, great. And then it's there. It's just there. But that's not it. He doesn't just know them and catalog them. He perceives them. He understands our thoughts and our words even before we speak them. I found myself thinking as I studied this week, how much would my thinking and speaking change if I was regularly aware of that providential presence of God? Lovingly examining even my thoughts and my words. But it's not just a psalm. In John chapter 4, Jesus is speaking with a woman at the well, and they're having this conversation, and eventually, she's there to draw water in the middle of the day, which says a whole bunch about her situation. But eventually Jesus talks about living water, and we get to this point in the conversation, picking it up in verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." And so he told her, "Go, call your husband and come back." "Well, I have no husband," she replied. And Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say that you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true." This woman is almost certainly an outcast in her community because of her past and present relationship. And what I find interesting is she's trying so hard to exist within what I would call a cloud of ambiguity underneath the watchful gaze of God and the person of Jesus Christ. Because he says, "Go and get your husband." And she says, "I have no husband." And is that true? Yeah. Is it the whole truth? Probably not. I think sometimes we live and operate like her. Just a reminder today that God sees through whatever cloudy ambiguity we might think exists between him and us. And when that woman at the well allows that cloudy ambiguity to burn away, and she sees Jesus for who he is, that he has this miraculous spiritual vision, and she calls him a prophet and even says, maybe this is the Messiah. What happens when she realizes the closeness? Does she like freak out and jump in the well to get away? No. It changes the entire trajectory of her life to be known in this way. She goes back to her village and says, "You guys have to come meet this guy. He told me things about me that I'd know you guys maybe didn't know. I don't know if I want to know them, but he knows all of it." And yet, it drew her closer to him. Here's the last one, Matthew 10. It's in the midst of a larger conversation, but I just want to focus on a few verses. "Are not sparrows sold for a penny," Jesus says, "yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside of your Father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." Do you guys know how many hairs are on your head? Good, because I do. I did some research. And it's actually interesting. I didn't know this. It depends on your hair color. On average, it depends on your hair color. So blondes, not only do blondes have more fun, they have more hair. Because blondes, on average, have about 150,000 hairs on their heads. Brunettes, black and brown colored hair, about 110,000 hairs on their heads. And redheads, as if they weren't already unique enough, have the least. They have about 90,000 hairs on their heads. As a quick side note, if you do the math, all those hairs times 7.9 billion people, it comes out to be approximately 7.7 quadrillion human hairs on the earth. God numbers all of them. By the way, even if you are follically challenged today, God still loves you and knows you. I want you to know that. Sometimes if you feel like the Bible doesn't connect, I promise, God still knows you. But I read a blog post about this week by author Brad Roth, and here's what he said about this idea of numbering things. When we read about God numbering things in Scripture, it actually speaks about both infinity and intimacy. Infinity and intimacy. And here's what we mean. First of all, infinity. A lot of times when it talks in Scripture about God numbering things, it's things that we would look at and go, that's way beyond numbering. I mean, hairs on the head is one example, but, you know, sand on the seashore, stars in the sky. So when it talks about numbering, it's that God has infinite knowledge of something. God has infinite knowledge of you and of me. But it's not just infinity, it's also intimacy. When it talks about God numbering something in Scripture, it's not just big infinite knowledge, but tiny intimate knowledge. One example might be from Scripture about how a shepherd numbers his sheep. Not just to count them so he can fill out the spreadsheet, but to know them intimately. And the example from the article I read, which I love, he talked about how you've probably seen, you know, a young parent counting the fingers and toes of that little baby. Why? Because they wonder how many there are? No. Because it's a sign of intimacy. They're numbering the digits of that little speck of human consciousness because of the deep love and connection that they have with that baby. Your God numbers you infinitely and intimately. And so I was thinking about all of these things, the mind-blowing statistics and the quotes and these examples from Scripture. But then I thought, really, it kind of all it comes down to that song we just sang together not too long ago. He's got the whole world in his hands. That's a big, you know, the whole world in his hands. There's a bigness, a vastness to that. But what I love is, what does the second verse say? He's got you and me. And if God is managing director, he can have the whole world in his hands, but he doesn't know much about me or care much for me. And I'm sorry, that's too small a view of who God is. He is so much bigger and so much more. He has the whole world, the whole universe in his hands, but it's also true that he numbers you and knows you intimately and infinitely. So let's think through a few of these things that we've discovered together today as we reflect on them, allowing them to sort of seep down into our souls. And these reflections are on the bulletin if you want to take that with you and look at them further this week after we're done with our time this morning. Here's the first one, though. Does the bigness of God or the vastness of creation or the mass of the human population lead you to feel insignificant? If so, that's kind of normal. Those are all really big things. But don't get lost there. It's not the end of your story. Secondly, invite God to remind you more regularly of the constant presence of the Spirit lovingly examining all the outward and inward parts of your life. Third, have you been attempting to live with a cloud of ambiguity between you and God lately? Like that woman at the well. And then lastly, just thank God today that he numbers you, that he knows you both infinitely and intimately. I'm going to scroll through those reflections again and still my voice for a moment. As soon as something grabs a hold of your heart, your mind, your soul, just feel free to focus on listening for the voice of the Spirit as we finish our time together. And I'm going to close that time with a word of prayer in just a moment.